This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past couple of weeks, U.S. commanders in Iraq have responded much more aggressively to insurgent attacks. Today, for example, American aircraft dropped 500-pound bombs on suspected ambush sites along roads in central Iraq. Last week, Operation Iron Hammer targeted buildings in Baghdad, and tanks rumbled through the rebellious city of Fallujah in a show of force. These are the most visible parts of a counterinsurgency operation that has thus far failed to stop the deadly and steadily increasing attacks in the areas west and north of Baghdad, known as the Sunni Triangle. Counterinsurgency is a term that covers a range of military and political tactics, persuasion and consultation and cooperation, yes, but bribery, intimidation, repression, and even assassination as well. In the past, the United States has used all of them in conflicts in Central America, in Vietnam, in the Philippines 100 years ago, and in Afghanistan right now. Which of these tools are appropriate and acceptable in Iraq? How effective are they? A little later in the program, we'll talk about the Massachusetts Supreme Court's decision on gay marriage and ask how the state legislature in Boston is going to address this issue. But first, counterinsurgency and the lessons of history. If you have questions about or experience with counterinsurgency, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Robert Killebrew, a retired Army colonel who's taught at the Army War College for 30 years. He joins us from Huntsville, Alabama, and it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation, Colonel.
Thanks, Neil. It's nice to be here.
Let's start with a definition. Insurgency, is that a specific term of art?
Well, the dictionary says that insurgency is any rising against civil authority. These days, what we use it to mean is any rising against authority, period. But in the war sense, it's usually guerrilla operations or some kind of clandestine operations against the sitting government.
Is it roughly equivalent to irregular warfare?
Yeah, the difference between the two definitions is essentially meaningless.
Does an insurgency differ from a guerrilla war?
No, not really. If you wanted to parse the term, you could say that an insurgency could also involve regular forces. The American Revolution and the Civil War were technically insurgencies, and they wound up being decided by regular forces.
Mm-hmm.
But in the general meaning of the term today, I think you're safe to say what you said.
Okay. Now, are there set criteria or established criteria, and obviously these things can change, but are there established criteria for what might make an insurgency successful?
No, usually insurgencies happen because part of the population of a country is dissatisfied with some part of the civil authority and has no other means of redress. If the insurgency can get enough popular support, and that's the critical part for Iraq right now, if the insurgency can garner enough popular support, it can become unstoppable. It can be cut off in the early stages, though.
Is it primarily a military or a political problem, or both?
It's both. Obviously, it's both. People rebel or conduct guerrilla warfare against regular forces and against the government because they have no other way of achieving their goals. One of their goals will be, though, to bring the regular force over onto their side. If you're a student of Mao Zedong, you know that he said the end of guerrilla warfare is transition to regular conventional war.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you look at what's happening in Iraq, how does that compare what's going on now to other insurgencies? And we're talking primarily about the American experience, say, Vietnam or Central America.
Well, you have to walk carefully. I don't want to sound like an academic,
but
every insurgency is different, and it's a product of its specific time and place. To me, at least, and I fought in Vietnam, what's happening in Iraq right now bears very little resemblance to Vietnam at all. In Vietnam, you had, at least from the Viet Cong were around, you had a fairly popular, widespread insurgency through the breadth of the whole country, supported by outside sponsors. In the case of Iraq, it appears that we have a fairly narrow, small group compared to the population, with no significant outside sponsorship that I can see.
Mm-hmm. And the outside sponsorship, of course, in Vietnam included not only North Vietnam, but more importantly, perhaps, China and the Soviet Union as well.
Absolutely. And speaking as a guy who walked on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, You have to remember that the Vietnamese War was furthered and eventually made successful by that kind of outside sponsorship. There's nothing like that in Iraq today, and it's quite possible, and I think we're planning on those people to eventually either be attrited down to an insignificant force or to be overtaken by successful political reform, and the bulk of them just lay down their weapons and go home.
Mm-hmm. Yet successful political reform would seem to require enough of a security blanket to operate. Obviously, a lot of international aid agencies have been driven out of Iraq.
Oh, absolutely, and that's clearly the objective of the insurgent force there now. Insurgents want their movement to become popular and widespread. They want to deny success to the civil order. Clearly, they've had some success in driving away civil organizations like international aid agencies. The question is how successful they're going to be in perpetrating and spreading their cause among the civil population. And I frankly don't see that happening right now.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Frank, who joins us on the line from Cottonwood, Arizona. Hello, Frank. Frank, are you there? I guess Frank is not there. So we'll hang up on Frank and go to Tim, who's with us from San Diego.
Hello.
Hi, Tim. You're on the air. Hello, Tim. Well, evidently we may be having difficulty with our phone lines.
Hello.
We're having an insurgency on the phone line.
There you go. Tim, are you there? Hello, Tim. Well, Tim is apparently having difficulty hearing us, so I'm going to put him on hold, and we'll see if we can work this problem out and try to get back to him a little bit later. And I apologize to the earlier caller if he couldn't hear us and ask him to call back and get his question in. But Colonel Killebrew, why don't we go on and ask about tactics to counter insurgency? If all insurgencies are unique, obviously the tactics that may work in one circumstance might not in another?
That's absolutely right, and this, your success against an insurgency depends on the manner in which you mix both armed force, political reform, and reward. In the case of force, it's technically possible to end an insurgency with force alone. That has been done in the past. Was done in Syria not long ago at the cost of some tens of thousands of dead Syrians.
Indeed, some could say that Saddam Hussein used that tactic at the end of the first Gulf War.
I was about to say Saddam Hussein's the latest practitioner. That clearly, though, is not what the United States is about. So our methods have got to be a mixture of political reform, in the case of Iraq, even standing up a political body and turning the country back over to the Iraqis, sufficient force to contain the insurgency, and some rewards for the people who run risks to try to help us achieve our goals.
Those people who we would regard as allies and the insurgents would regard as collaborators.
Absolutely. And I might add this, the Saddam Hussein tape out just recently and other similar tapes are branding the people who work with us as collaborators and traitors. That's a common tactic.
I think we've restored our phone. Fixed our phone problem, so let's try again. And Tim, you're on the line in San Diego.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I am very questionable of the current tactics in Iraq. I know Clinton received a lot of flack for seemingly ineffective missile strikes on empty tents in the desert. And this morning, hearing about dropping 500-pound bombs on empty athletic fields and street corners just befuddles me. I think we're really losing it there.
Colonel Killebrew?
Well, I heard the same report, Tim. I'm not there, so I can't judge. But I do know that our troops that are there are closely engaged with the insurgents. Now, because they're on the ground, the kind of weapons they're using in particular cases, I can't judge myself. Unspoken story, and one reason why you hear the complaints coming out of the administration about news coverage are the things that are happening on the positive side in Iraq, dealing with civil reform and standing up Iraqi security forces. To me, that's the story we have to follow.
But that clearly is happening in some parts of Iraq and clearly not in others.
Absolutely right. We're having great success in the south and the north, and the center is still weak. But we should not forget that even in the center, and particularly in Baghdad, maybe especially in Baghdad, there are thousands of Iraqis now who have decided to stay on our side, who are risking their lives for us.
Yes, I think we run a great risk of alienating people where we are attacking also suspected terrorists and suspected resistance fighters, where if there's any incident where we attack even just one innocent party, we're going to lose a lot of support in the area.
You're absolutely right, and that's the problem with using force. You have to just accept that eventually, if you use a force only, eventually you'll turn the population away from you.
Tim, thanks very much, and let's get another question in. This is Myra, who's with us in Madisonville, Kentucky.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for answering my call.
Sure.
My question is, I was thinking in terms of the Palestinians in Israel, and my question is, at what point does insurgency cross the line and become terrorism?
That's an awfully good question. As you know, there are problems going on in Israel right now between the army and the civil population because they're having real misgivings about their success using armed force. Myra, I don't know. It would depend on the impact of actions at the spot.
Okay. Thank you.
And Myra, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go now to VJ, who's with us from Springfield, Tennessee.
Yes, sir. My question is, would he label Gandhi as an insurgent?
Mahatma Gandhi.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Colonel Killebrew?
I'd label him an insurgent, and I think the British probably would, too. But he was a unique kind of insurgent, wasn't he? He rebelled against the civil authority, but he pioneered the use of nonviolence in insurgency. And it worked fairly well. But we have to remember also, though, that Gandhi spearheaded an Indian nationalist movement that had its violent edges, too.
And might it not have worked had he been confronting a more ruthless foe?
You're absolutely right. If you're going to conduct a nonviolent insurgency, it's best to pick your opponent carefully.
Oh, yes.
Nonviolence works against the Brits, works against us, works against most civilized countries, particularly since CNN came along, but it certainly wouldn't have worked against Saddam.
VJ, good question. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. We just have about a minute left with you, Colonel, and I know you've got to run. But as you look at what's going on, I mean, is there any way to characterize? I mean, there are all kinds of darker sides of counterinsurgency, and we mentioned, you know, assassination, and as in the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Are any of those appropriate, do you think, in the Iraqi situation?
In Iraq? I don't think so. The situation just hasn't developed the way Vietnam did, first. And second, I'm not quite sure that some of the techniques that were used in Vietnam would be viable in the age of CNN.
So the political side of news coverage is a major factor in all of this.
Absolutely. And you'd better believe the insurgent always seeks to use news coverage to his advantage. Remember, the Phoenix program in Vietnam was designed to take out Viet Cong cadre leadership at the village level. Something like that is probably still possible today. But certainly the laying in wait and the assassination that we and the South Vietnamese employed would not be practical today.
We're talking about the history of insurgent movements and the strategies to deal with them. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later this hour, we'll discuss today's ruling on gay marriage by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Right now, we'll continue our conversation about insurgencies like the one the U.S. is currently coping with in Iraq. Our guest is Robert Killebrew, a retired Army colonel and a consultant in national security affairs. He's with us from Huntsville, Alabama. As you may know, there's been some violent weather in that part of the country. He's been asked to relocate for safety. Of course, we want him to do that, so we may get him back on the line if he's able to join us. The U.S. has increased its military offensive in response to attacks by Iraqi insurgents, but military tactics, as we mentioned, are not the only answer. Robert Rotberg joins us now. He's director of the Program on Intrastate Conflict and Conflict Resolution at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also the author of Why States Fail, Causes and Consequences. He joins us from his offices in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's good of you to be with us today.
My pleasure.
Are there any recent examples, do you think, of insurgent movements that have been quelled by non-military means?
Well, insurgents are never put off by purely non-military means, but by the same token, military means are never sufficient. Look at Malaysia several decades ago, the Philippines decades ago, parts of India, Mexico more recently, Mozambique more recently.
Mm-hmm.
In each of these situations, winning hearts and minds was critical to reducing the power of rebels or insurgents.
Our listeners might be most familiar with the Mexican situation. I assume you're talking about Chiapas.
About Chiapas, yes. The Mexican government realized that military means would not deal effectively with the insurgents in a sustained way, and what they did in a sensible way was to begin to provide the kinds of goods and services that would give the people of Chiapas a sense that the government of Mexico would treat them fairly and that would give them a better sense of a future to come. And I think in all situations, Iraq is a good example. The people, the bystanders, most of the people of the country are looking to see whether the interveners are capable of providing a better future for them or whether they'd better stick with the possibility of the insurgents winning.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, winning hearts and minds is critical.
Yeah. What are some of the tactics that you would point to in history that have been successful in that regard?
Well, it's critical to achieve legitimacy, and that depends in all these post-insurgent or insurgent situations. It depends entirely upon the perceived results, upon the creation of a renewed sense of personal security, the establishment of a high semblance of order, an effective of a predictability, but most of all the promise of a better future to come, and a reinvigoration of the engines of growth and commerce. So getting the power back on, getting the water running, providing that the roads are free of burglars and robbers is critical, something that hasn't happened in Iraq or in most of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, they're having more power problems in central Iraq, and apparently word today that it may be some time before a regular 24/7 power is going to be available to the Iraqi capital, so that's going to be a continuing problem.
Right, and it's important to get a justice system moving so that the rule of law comes back. You need stability and order for all of that, but you need also to start consulting with the local people, as in Chiapas, as in Malaysia, the Philippines, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very belatedly starting to consult with the Iraqis in a systematic way. Clearly, our efforts so far have been marked by a lack of success.
As you look back on it, though, you just mentioned an important point. It's impossible to make this political progress to win the hearts and minds unless there's some degree of some semblance of security.
Oh, absolutely. It's important that there should be a strong velvet hand as well as a mailed fist. They go together, but you can't just use the mailed fist. That's the important point. And one can't use gunships and expect the people to respond as if they're looking forward to the next sally of gunships.
Colonel Killebrew is back with us from Huntsville, Alabama. And, Colonel, I don't mean to promote you to Vice President of the United States, but I hope you're in a secure location.
I am. Thank you.
Okay. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Rose, and Rose is with us from Miami Beach.
Yes. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, you're on the air, Rose.
Good. You know, one thing that strikes me, all too familiar, from the Vietnam War all the way down to what we're experiencing now in Iran, Iraq, is that these are all undeclared wars.
Undeclared by the part of the United States, you mean?
Yes. And not only are they undeclared, but none of them are finished. We are still at a standstill with Korea. We're still at a standstill with Vietnam. We're still at a standstill with every one of these undeclared wars.
Well, Korea, of course, was authorized by the United Nations Security Council.
Yeah, but we're not over with them.
I didn't say that.
We're just at a standstill.
Legitimacy. Let me ask you both about that. I think that's the issue that Rose is asking about, the legitimacy of the conflict and whether that has an effect on the situation in trying to put down insurgencies or persuade the insurgents to come over to your side. Colonel Killebrew, what do you think?
I think the legitimacy that matters now is the legitimacy of Iraqi political authority in their own country. It almost doesn't matter how or why we got into this fight in terms of ending it on the ground there. We won't be able to end it until the Iraqis themselves have a legitimate political and civil authority in their own country, and they see themselves as running their own affairs.
Robert Rotberg, legitimacy?
Yeah, that's reasonable, but it's also important that the interveners with 125,000, 130,000 troops become more legitimate than they have been perceived to be since the shooting war was over, the main shooting war. Legitimacy dissipates as it dissipated in Iraq very, very quickly. A liberating power wins hearts and minds not by advertising and public relations, but by a performance. And a performance includes security. It also includes the things we talked about earlier, power and light, and getting the roads clear.
Robert Rotberg, let me ask you, as you look again at the lessons of history, is withdrawal a viable answer?
Not really in terms of winning hearts and minds, because withdrawal is effectively giving up. We were in Haiti from 1915 to 1932. We faced Iraqi-type rebellions during the 1920s, and when Franklin Delano Roosevelt became president, he just gave up and pulled us out, which was the smart thing to do at that point. We had had a long run, but hadn't ever won the hearts and minds, and still haven't in that particular country.
And obviously there was eventually a forced pullout from Vietnam and then a forced eviction.
Well, Vietnam is somewhat different, but certainly we never had legitimacy. We were backing the wrong dog in that fight and hadn't established ourselves as doing what the Vietnamese people thought they wanted. I'm not suggesting that there was an objective right and wrong, but we certainly didn't win the hearts and minds of the entire country backing a king who wasn't perceived as legitimate himself.
Okay. And Robert Rotberg, I wanted to thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Robert Rotberg is director of the Program on Intrastate Conflict and Conflict Resolution at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was with us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And joining us now is Max Boot. He's a senior fellow of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, the author of The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power. He's with us from his home in Larchmont, New York, and it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much.
Some people, as we've been saying, compare the situation in Iraq to Vietnam. We heard earlier from Colonel Killebrew as to why he thinks the comparison is inapt. But are there lessons to be drawn from Vietnam that could help us, guide us to coping with this insurgency?
I think so. I mean, I think I completely agree that Iraq is no Vietnam. I mean, the scale of the challenge we face is just much lesser in Vietnam. We were facing more than 1 million enemy combatants, and in Iraq we're facing probably a few thousand at most. But nevertheless, I think we can learn from Vietnam because we did a lot of things wrong in Vietnam, and we also did some things right, which people tend to forget. But the thing that we did wrong mainly was to focus on the conventional part of the war, using an awful lot of firepower to try to defeat a guerrilla insurgency, which just wasn't working. But on the other hand, we did have some very successful lower-level counterinsurgency programs that did work well. For example, the Marines Combined Action Platoons, which put a small squad of Marines into one village to work with the South Vietnamese militia on winning hearts and minds and on chasing the Viet Cong out of the village. Those kinds of lower-level counterinsurgency programs proved very successful, but the Army in Vietnam is too busy utilizing its conventional approach and therefore fought the wrong way. So I think it's very important for us in Iraq now to remember the right and the wrong way to fight a counterinsurgency. And frankly, I'm a little bit worried when I see these reports about the military dropping 500-pound bombs and sending tanks out. I mean, that's a great show of force, but I don't think that's the right way to deal with this elusive foe.
Mm-hmm. Colonel Killebrew, let's bring you into this conversation. Occasionally, doesn't a show of force, an intimidation factor, doesn't that affect the psychology of the situation, or is it counterproductive?
Oh, sure. I think the key is the way you use force and the way you mix your different kinds of force. I read Max's column recently where he talked about the combined arms platoon, and I agreed with him to a point. But when you're facing an enemy that has more firepower than your CAP, then you obviously need a larger force. I think from what I can see and from what I hear from Iraq today, from the guys over there and the stuff that appears in popular press, I think our commanders are aware of the need to mix and match force. And I think you'll find a different way of using force going on throughout the country, depending on the opposition in the area.
And even if it is Operation Iron Hammer, which is another operation going on today in Baghdad, even as we speak, Max Boot, do you suspect that there are other things going on as well?
Sure, there's an awful lot of things going on which don't receive as much attention. And Colonel Killebrew is absolutely right. There are lower-level programs. When you go around Iraq, you quickly realize that there is an awful lot of work being done on building up the police forces and that kind of thing. But I do have some concerns about where the main effort is. And one of the problems, of course, is that, as the Army learned in Vietnam, it is sometimes counterproductive to expend too much firepower when you're dealing with guerrillas. And that's a constant challenge because you don't want to appear soft. But on the other hand, you don't want to just start shooting and killing a lot of innocent civilians. And I'm not saying they're doing that in Iraq, but that's always a danger of these kinds of battles. So you have to carefully calibrate what you're doing and not create more enemies than you take off the streets.
If I could come in just for a second, Max used a term that's very, very important, and that is where you're putting the main effort. In an insurgency, in any kind of insurgency that the United States fights, the main effort is always political and social. And that's the concern I have about what's going on in Iraq right now. From what I see and hear, there are Iraqis who are prepared to play a greater role in the political life of their country, and we've got to find a way to wrap those people in soon so they get some idea that they're going to see a return to civil order and a management of their own affairs.
Colonel Killebrew, thank you for braving the weather there to join us today. We appreciate it.
I was happy to be here.
Robert Killebrew taught strategy at the Army War College for 30 years. He joined us today from Huntsville, Alabama. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Max Boot is still with us, and let's get a caller on the line. This is Jose, who's with us from San Pablo, California.
Oh, hello. Yes, I'm enjoying this conversation, and I refer you back to the beginning when you were defining counterinsurgency, and which I understood quite well, and I wondered what the difference was between the concept counterinsurgency and the other concept used in Vietnam, which was pacification. And to clarify that pacification concept was also used in Central America, particularly in Guatemala and in El Salvador. And I believe it's been used in Israel, and the Israelis, in fact, were advising the people in, I believe, El Salvador and Guatemala on the concept of pacification, which was a big deal in Vietnam. And I wondered what the difference between counterinsurgency and pacification.
might be defined as.
Thank you, Jose. Max Boot, is there a significant difference there?
I'm not aware of any substantive difference. To my mind, they're basically synonyms, and I think the word pacification got a little bit discredited in Vietnam, and so people don't like to use it anymore, and they like to talk about counterinsurgency, but I think it's basically the same thing, which is how do you defeat an elusive foe who doesn't wear a uniform, who lurks in the shadows and emerges to ambush you? How do you keep them from winning over the base of the civilian support that they need to operate?
Okay, let's get another caller. Wayne is with us from Bristol, Vermont.
Yes, hi there.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question about a comparison to the insurgency in Iraq, not with Vietnam, but with the Russian-Afghanistan war in the late 70, early 80 period, and also that I was listening to a news program last night, I think on CNN, where they said that in Iraq there may be as many as 50,000 insurgents, not just 5,000.
One of the U.S. generals was quoted the other day as saying 5,000. Max Boot?
Again, I don't think there's that much direct comparison between Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, people might see a little bit of a comparison in the fact that we're now losing some helicopters in Iraq, which, and the Russians certainly lost a lot of gunships in Afghanistan once we supplied the Mujahideen with Stinger missiles. But there's not that much comparison. There are a lot of differences. For example, that there were many more guerrilla fighters in Afghanistan. They had much more favorable terrain. In general, the terrain in Afghanistan, with all the hills and caves and valleys, is much more favorable to guerrilla operations than in Iraq, which is largely flat. And, of course, the biggest difference is that the guerrillas in Afghanistan had a massive amount of external support from the Pakistanis, from the United States, from the Saudis and others, and the insurgents in Iraq don't have that much, as far as I know, external support. One other point that I would mention is that the Russian conquest of Afghanistan, which is how it was seen, had almost no popular legitimacy within Afghanistan. The Russians were trying to put down Islam. They were trying to establish atheism as being the model of the state. They were doing a lot of things to alienate the bulk of the population. There's no sign, as far as I'm aware, that we've alienated the bulk of the population, because clearly we are not aiming for a long-term takeover of Iraq. We're trying to establish democracy there. And in fact, if we had alienated the bulk of the population, I think what you'd be seeing a much worse guerrilla war going on right now. It's so far been rather limited, I think, because most people are either on our side or largely apathetic. They're certainly not supporting these guerrillas who are trying to bring back Saddam's discredited tyranny.
Wayne, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And Max Boot, we just have 30 seconds left with you, but I know you emphasize the importance of cooperating with local forces.
Absolutely vital, because they have all sorts of advantages in gathering intelligence and figuring out who the bad guys are, who are the good people. So you have to work with them. But at the same time, you can't dump too much on them too soon, which I think is a danger we're in right now. We're accelerating the deployment of Iraqi security forces, but they may not be well trained. They may not be well armed. And so just sticking them on the street isn't going to do the job. You have to work with them to make sure they can take on this substantial burden of fighting these very dedicated Ba'athists and jihadis who are fighting with ruthless intent.
Max Boot, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Max Boot, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the author of The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court on gay marriage. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.